On the first day of the week, very early in the morning, the women took the spices they had prepared and went to the tomb. They found the stone rolled away from the tomb, but when they entered, they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus.
While they were wondering about this, suddenly two men in clothes that gleamed like lightning stood beside them. In their fright, the women bowed down with their faces to the ground, but the men said to them,
"Why do you look for the living among the dead? He's not here. He has risen. Remember how he told you while he was still with you in Galilee, 'The Son of Man must be delivered over to the hands of sinners, be crucified, and on the third day be raised again.'"
Then they remembered his words.
When they came back from the tomb, they told all these things to the 11 and to all the others.
It was Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary, the mother of James, and the others with them who told this to the apostles.
But they did not believe the women because their words seemed to them like nonsense.
Peter, however, got up and ran to the tomb. Bending over, he saw the strips of linen lying by themselves, and he went away, wondering to himself what had happened.
No one expected the tomb to be empty. Not one. Not the women who went to prepare Jesus' body, not the bewildered and despondent disciples who are now huddling together out of sight. Not the people who had spent their whole lives poring over the scriptures, those ancient texts looking for clues about who Messiah would be and what he would do and where he would come from, when he would arrive. Not even those who had unflinchingly and unfailingly paid attention to Jesus' teachings and were convinced by his demonstrations of power or those amazing signs of compassion. On Friday, everyone who watched and wondered if Jesus was truly the Messiah saw their hopes come to an end. It's true that Jesus had spoken about resurrection along the way, hinted at the possibility. If you remember in our study in Luke 9, he even predicted it earlier in the text, but nobody heard that. He had just sent out the 12 to do some amazing ministry of their own, and they were even more excited than ever about Jesus and the way he was going to overthrow Rome. He had just fed 5,000 people, and folks were fat and happy. Things were going so well. Later, two of Jesus' greatest stories, the prodigal son and the rich man and Lazarus, foreshadow the possibility of death and resurrection, that they just might be on the horizon. But those were just interesting teaching devices. And of course, there was the other Lazarus and Jairus' daughter and the son of the widow of Nain. None of them were confined by death, at least that's what the story tells us. But Jesus had done that for other people in order to prove his power. At this point in the story, all we know is that something strange has occurred. Jesus is not where his followers thought he would be, they expected him to be. And by the angel's account, you won't find him among the dead. The women who were first on the scene, and usually throughout the story, the first ones to be faithful, come and report what the angel has told them. But the men, those smart men, are disbelieving. After all, they're just women. And nobody takes women seriously. But these women were faithful. They loved Jesus just as passionately as they did. And they had been with him since the beginning too. And so the report is this: he is risen. And now all of them are left with a question. Will they seek him? Will they seek him? If this story is true, that Christ is risen, it's the defining moment in human history. And it's one that confronts all of us. Despite the fact that it's so surprising, seems to make no sense at all, and feels entirely implausible. The question is, will you seek him? For all his faults, Peter runs to look, and we're told elsewhere in John's gospel that he joins him as well, hurrying themselves to the tomb to see if it could possibly be true. Some say that seeking God with an open mind requires humility and an open heart, a whole heart, to find him. It's an intentional pursuit rather than a passive one. As I said to the kids, the prophet Jeremiah says it this way, "You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart." Jeremiah 29. So as we reflect on the news that Jesus is risen this Easter morning, I invite you to take a few minutes in the silence and consider this query. How will I seek him, or will I seek him? Will I seek him? How? And where?
Now, that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. They were talking with each other about everything that had happened.
As they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked along with them, but they were kept from recognizing him. He asked them,
"What are you discussing together as you walk along?"
They stood still, their faces downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, asked him,
"Are you the only one visiting Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened there in these days?"
"What things?"
"About Jesus of Nazareth. He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one that was going to redeem Israel. And what is more, it is the third day since all this took place. In addition, some of our women amazed us. They went to the tomb early this morning, but they didn't find his body. They came and told us that they had seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. Then some of our companions went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they didn't see Jesus."
"How foolish you are, and how slow to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did not the Messiah have to suffer these things and then enter his glory?"
And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself.
As they approached the village to which they were going, Jesus continued on as if he was going further, but they urged him strongly,
"Stay with us, for it is nearly evening. The day is almost over."
So he went in to stay with them.
When he was at the table with them, he took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and began to give it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he disappeared from their sight.
They asked each other,
"Were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us?"
They got up and returned at once to Jerusalem. There they found the 11 and those with him, assembled together and saying,
"It is true. The Lord has risen and has appeared to Simon."
Then the two told what had happened on the way and how Jesus was recognized by them when he broke the bread.
Two of Jesus' disciples are fleeing Jerusalem after he's killed when a stranger comes near and begins walking with them. Like all the rest of his followers, they're distraught. Or his followers, they're distraught. They wanted so badly for him to be the Redeemer of Israel, the one who would save them from their suffering. They just couldn't imagine, like all the others, that this Messiah was going to save them through suffering. Cleopas and most likely his wife are stunned that this person seems to know nothing about what's been happening in Jerusalem. The tone of the passage, as you read it in the original language, suggests something like, "Have you been in a coma or what? How can you not know about everything that's happened to Jesus?" Now, I don't know what a resurrected body looks like, and apparently they didn't either. The Bible seems to support the idea that there's something qualitatively different about it, making it hard to recognize. It made it hard for everybody to recognize Jesus. But when he speaks to them, and their initial fear gives way to his presence, something begins to resonate within them. Something ignites within them. And in their willingness to listen, their minds are open, their hearts soften, and they begin to turn in a new direction, see things in a new light. Last week, we talked about the day of visitation, the prospect that God at different times comes into each of our lives to seek to reveal God's self to us. God does indeed pursue us, and this is one of those days of visitation. In welcoming him, they remember and are remembered into his life and into his presence in communion with him. I think I've mentioned in the past that in Hebrew, to remember, at least some of the times, means to make present. When you think about something, when you reflect on something, it returns that reality to you. And so as they listened to him, all their experiences of him, all the messages that had shifted their understanding of reality and truth began to come flooding back. And their slow hearts that could not or would not see the truth that was right in front of them come alive. And they're rejoined in the fellowship of the burning heart. People who've experienced the risen one. Those who see the reality that that risen one is the same one who had been crucified, who had walked among them. All this happens because they respond to his presence. They're willing to walk with him. They're willing to listen to him, commune with him. And in doing so, not only are their eyes open to a new reality, their hearts are moved and their lives are altered and change direction. Because in the next moment, they're going to head back to Jerusalem to face its dangers and its threats in order to regather with this community of followers that had been fractured. As we've seen repeatedly in our study of Luke, to know Jesus is to follow him wherever he leads. Even in this story, it's not enough to say that we believe in the crucifixion of Christ. Our old self has to be crucified with him. Says Romans 6:5. It's not enough to say that we believe that Jesus was raised from the dead. We've got to be raised with him to walk in the newness of life, which is what Romans 6:1-11 says. There is, I believe, a physical Easter that happened in history, and there's a spiritual Easter that happens in our hearts so that we begin to walk in that newness of life, Romans 6:3. And so as we enter into a second time of reflection, I invite you to consider these queries. Will I walk with him? Welcome him in. Listen to him. Go where he leads.
Talking about this, Jesus himself stood among them and said to them,
"Peace be with you."
They were startled and frightened, thinking they had saw a ghost. He said to them,
"Why are you troubled, and why do doubts rise in your mind? Look at my hands and my feet. It is I myself. Touch me and see. A ghost does not have flesh and bones, as you see I have."
When he had said this, he showed them his hands and feet.
And while they still did not believe it, because of joy and amazement, he asked them,
"Do you have anything here to eat?"
They gave him a piece of broiled fish, and he took it and ate it in their presence. He said to them,
"This is what I told you while I was still with you. Everything must be fulfilled that is written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms."
Then he opened their minds so they could understand the scriptures. He told them,
"This is what is written. The Messiah will suffer and rise from the dead on the third day, and repentance for the forgiveness of sins will be preached in his name to all nations, beginning at Jerusalem. You are witnesses of these things. I am going to send you what my Father has promised, but stay in the city until you have been clothed with power from on high.
Like that, they left him. No. While they were still talking about this, Jesus himself stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Yeah, right. Startled and frightened only begins to describe their reaction. A better translation is probably terrified and awestruck. Terrified, as the text says, that maybe this was a ghost. Terrified that their expectations about how this was all going to look were so wrong. Terrorized by the violence and the threat of an empire that would kill someone this good. Awestruck that maybe their deepest hopes were in fact true. Awestruck in the sense of fearing God, of just being in awe of how amazing God is. Maybe awestruck that the empire, which seems so powerful, actually doesn't have the last word. Again, as Jesus does for them and for us, so patiently and willingly opens minds and hearts to something new. And he walks them through the salvation history of the Old Testament in a way that they couldn't see it before. It's one of the things that keeps coming out of the text is that folks just couldn't see it until he was present with them to explain it. Maybe Jesus helped them see some of the Psalms, like Psalm 16 or Psalm 22 in a new light. Or focus their attention on Isaiah 53, which I encourage you to read. Or maybe some of the promises in Joel 2 that actually will soon be revealed and fleshed out in Acts chapter 2. Here Jesus helps them begin to understand that this resurrection is not for his sake, but for theirs. He's back and he's ready to lead them in a new and empowered way if they're willing to be his ongoing witnesses to the coming kingdom. He's ready to clothe them with power, to accompany them in a new way so that we don't have to just rely on our own wisdom and effort and authority. We are meant to be accompanied people, empowered by the Spirit, joined in the presence and the bond of peace, so much so that we have nothing to fear. Too often, we Christians have turned the story of the resurrection into life after death or going to heaven. But for Jesus and these first century followers, resurrection is about embodying a new way of living in God's new world. They were so convinced that what happened on Easter, that it was so central to their lives and their life together, that many of them, in some of the earliest writings, began to talk about it as the eighth day of the week, the first day of the new creation. That's what every Sunday was, the eighth day of the week, the first day of the new creation. And this eighth day was a way of signaling a new way of being in the world in the wake of this powerful experience. Not just reading a text, but the experience of having been met by the one who was alive, who died, and is now resurrected. That pattern of worship coming together was a way of reminding them that this is the reality that they're called to live into. And in doing so, they announced that God's creative activity was continuing through the living and risen presence of Christ through them and through all of his followers. Jesus in this passage invites his followers into that moment to bear witness to this reality, not just by showing up on a Sunday morning for worship. That's a nice thing. I'd even argue it's a helpful thing. But by showing up each and every day in word and deed, by the content and the character of our lives, by the priorities we choose to adopt, by the big and small choices we make in the way that we order our lives, in the allegiances that we make, in the very practical ways that we treat one another as brothers and sisters in Christ, in the way we treat our neighbors, in the way we treat those who would otherwise see us as their enemies. So as we move into this last time for reflection, I'll pose this query for our consideration. And it's written in the singular, but I think about it for us as a community as well. Will I be a witness for him? Will we be witnesses for him? And if so, how?
We walk in the loving gaze of God. Will we seek Christ? Will we walk, welcome, listen, and follow him? Will and how will we be witnesses for Christ? Go forth into this day in the light and love of God.